Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode of the Racket Magazine podcast is brought to you by Sergio Tacchini, offering iconic tracksuits, classic polos, and the new Youngline sneaker. Originally designed in the mid-1980s, it's our favorite spring silhouette, and it's back. You can get it now at sergiotacchini.com and follow them on Instagram at sergiotacchini_official for updates. Enter the promo code RACKETMAG at checkout, and you'll get 30% off your order.
So it was a joke one day to him. I said, can you imagine a white bodysuit with women? Wouldn't that be funny?
Renee, here we are in New York. We are not in London.
I know. It's really, really sad. It's so sad that yesterday I actually got on the computer and I ordered myself a 2020 Wimbledon towel. Because clearly you've seen my house and my apartment, and I have every towel from 1989, from the first time that I ever played at Wimbledon. So this is the first time in, 32 years that I will not be in London, and it's so sad. Obviously I have an amazing amount of memories from there, and but 2020 is definitely not a good year for
2020 is really kicking our asses. However, it's given us a chance to look back, think big, make some changes. Hopefully there's some really intense conversations happening at some of the organizational levels, some of the, you know, governing body levels about what we want this sport to look like when it comes back. And that's not just in terms of safety, which is obviously the case, but, you know, making a more equitable sport, making a sport that is a little bit less elitist, that's a little bit more welcoming. You know, I think from what I've heard, those are conversations that are happening. Obviously, we talked to Katrina Adams about some of this stuff. You know, and one thing we are going to do this week is look back a little bit because we have a phenomenal guest who made Wimbledon history. And before we get to her, I want to hear a little bit about some of your favorite stories at Wimbledon. It seems like of all the Grand Slams, certainly, despite the fact that you're an Australian, the Wimbledon experience was one that is extremely close to your heart. Tell us some of your favorite stuff.
Yeah, I mean, listen, growing up in Australia, we obviously to watch Wimbledon, we'd have to get up at like 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, that was just how it was because of the time difference. So every single night I would get up and watch either one match or some of a match. I'll never forget my mom just like tapping me on the shoulder and be like, Ren, you know, Borg's on. You know, when I was a really young kid, I was obsessed with Bjorn Borg and Yvonne Gulligan-Coley. Those were my two like favorites. And then, of course, Chrissy and Martina. Like, even if you're not a tennis player, everyone would watch Wimbledon.
Yeah. I used to watch it with my grandparents, and the NBC theme music that was so cheesy was such an indelible part of my mornings. Yeah. And then the championship weekend, watching Boris Becker win in 85, I think it was one of the seminal. I think it was the first tennis match I remember on TV at Wimbledon, just thinking, wow, this is so amazing. I'm watching history.
You know, when I obviously had an opportunity to go and play there, it was amazing, you know, but very different to what I ended up, you know, experiencing there, obviously. But I had to go to qualifying the first year I went in 89, and I had to take a train like 30 minutes to Wimbledon, and then I had to get a transportation from Wimbledon to Roehampton. I mean, there was no luxury in having to qualify for Wimbledon for me. This was just like, and I wasn't complaining about any of it. Like, and I remember my last round of qualifying. I remember my first match. I played Barbara Rittner from Germany.
The German Fed Cup.
German
coach,
Fed
still
Cup.
Very
coach.
Involved in tennis.
Yeah, I think it was the first time I ever dove on a court. Was in that match, and she still talks about it. She's like, remember that? I was like, yeah, I couldn't even believe I did that. And then the last match was against Jennifer Santrock from the United States, and she was a lefty, and it rained in the middle of the match. I won the first set. She double folded as it was raining on the first set point, and, you know, had to come back. And I just kept thinking, oh my God, I'm one set away from qualifying for Wimbledon. I mean, it's just insane for me to even think about. And then I went back out and I won the match, and I had a forehand volley to win the match. It was the most nervous open court forehand volley I've ever hit in my life. And I remember when I hit it in, I just thought, oh my God, like, this is the greatest moment of my life. And obviously then to go and play there and get your badge and walk through those gates as a competitor is just amazing. And then obviously, you know, winning the doubles there twice in 01 and 04 with Lisa Raymond and with Cara Black. I mean, they're just dreams that you just can't imagine.
I mean, and let's not forget that you won the Legends with Kim Clijsters in 2018. Demonstrating.
I've actually won the Legends twice.
Oh, sorry. The one I saw.
Yeah, okay.
That's Kim Clijsters, you and she partnered up and you hit a diving volley.
I did.
Unbelievable volley. I think the commentator jumped out of his chair. It's one of the best examples of a diving volley that you hit 2 years ago that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I almost broke my hand because I landed on the racket. Oh, I have had more dives at Wimbledon. I had one around the net post playing against Barbara Schett, and Barbara started laughing her ass off because she's like, this is Legends. What are you doing?
You know, but
I just can't help it. I mean, when I would dive on hard court. So for me on grass, it just comes naturally. Actually, one of my best dives at Wimbledon was against Kim, playing mixed against her back when we were both playing full time. So I don't know. I was playing with Marcello Mello and he basically looked at me and turned around and like started bowing. He was like, that was amazing. But, you know, I know that like Sam Stoes is always like, God, I wish I could dive once. And I'm like, listen, no, you either can do it or you can't.
Yeah. So it's something you can practice. I imagine.
And if you try and do it when you don't know how to do it, you can really hurt yourself. So,
well, there's something really special about, obviously my experience there has been both as a spectator and as a journalist, but I would encourage anybody who might be on the fence about going, or maybe is thinking about making it, you know, making the trip. Wimbledon on TV and Wimbledon in lore is really fancy and it's elite. And we talk a lot about the tea and the breakfast of Wimbledon and the cream and the strawberries and all the traditions. And that's all
and
true.
The Pimm's cups.
But in person, the experience is actually remarkably democratic. It's a remarkably open institution. The first time I ever went was a spectator. I queued up. I paid £20 for my ticket. I spent one of the most wonderful days of my life just roaming from court to court. And it's beautiful and it's manicured, but it's not a place that feels exclusionary
or stuffy.
It's really open and fun.
Well, you know, some of us, though, Caitlin, have managed to squeeze our way into the Royal Box a couple of times.
We're getting there. So tell me about the Royal Box experience, because for people who don't know, there's a special seating area in center court. You can be a guest of the royal family sitting in the Royal Box. And to get this is a huge honor. There's souvenirs involved. There's a waiting room. Tell us what it involves and how you even get invited.
Well, you have to be invited by the chairman of the All England Club. And I have been asked since I've gone back to do the Legends, as they call it, the Ladies Invitational. They really nicely ask a lot of the competitors that are there playing in the Ladies Invitational, where they're doing television and various things. And they often ask us to go to women's semifinals day or women's quarterfinals day. So they invite not all, but most of the competitors of the Ladies Invitational. And a lot of us are working, we can't fit it into our schedule, but I manage to fit it into my schedule every time they ask.
Sure.
Actually, the first time they ever asked me, I had to say no. And I said to Phil Brook, who's one that asked me, I went to him immediately the next time. I said, please, please, please invite me back, please, you know, because me to say no to that was. But it's just, I mean, it is so typically English. And so, I mean, don't take this wrong, super pompous, but it is exactly the way it should be. Yeah. I mean, they have, you know, lunch at a certain time, then you watch the match, then you're going to have tea afterwards, you have your little scones and your little, you know, finger sandwiches and tea and. It's just amazing.
They give you a little souvenir bag
full
of goodies, which you have gifted to me, at least one of the ones you got. So thank you for that. I still use it.
Yeah. It's just an honor.
But there's also royals in the box at times. Not all the time, but, you know, Kate Middleton will show up. Obviously, Prince William comes. When I went to
David Beckham.
Come on, David Beckham. He's basically a royal.
Maggie, the actress.
Maggie Smith. Dame Maggie Smith.
Yes, Dame Maggie
when
Smith.
When I was there last year, Phoebe Waller-Bridge was in
She was there the day before me.
I took
so bummed.
Like 400 like extremely far away like telephoto lens photos that made her look like just basically a blob, but she was, I mean, yeah. I was just happy
you
to
put
be
a circle
present.
Around her.
I was like, it's Phoebe Waller-Bridge, trust me, she's in there, you can't tell.
Yeah, I think she went
me.
The day before I did, so I was super bummed.
She was watching the Vika Halep match.
Oh, there you go.
Which I thought was going to be more of a barn burner, but didn't turn out. But, you know, Phoebe was there, so it was
so
cool.
That you were fine.
Tell me, before we get to introducing our guest, who's spectacular and a super interesting woman in a couple of very, very different ways, the last thing I want to ask you about is the skirt. Tell me about the skirt.
Oh, the skirt. Well, you know, so I was playing the Ladies Invitational with Kim Kleisters, and we were playing against Conchita Martinez and Andrea Jaeger. And we were up by pretty comfortably in the match. And Kim started talking to the crowd. We try and interact a little bit. We try and have some fun with the ladies Invitational. Some of the ladies don't have as much fun.
Seems
as,
like it varies.
As,
yeah, some are taking it real
some
serious.
Some it's a little bit too seriously. I'm not going to mention any names, but they
well,
know
also,
who they are.
The Kim Kleisters being in the Ladies Invitational.
Well, it's embarrassing.
Is embarrassing. I mean, yeah. She's a current player, basically, and
yeah.
She's playing against Andrea Jaeger.
Well,
is
she's
that
got
fair?
Three kids. Okay.
Sure, sure, sure. Okay. Setting that aside.
Yeah. So anyway, Kim and I are playing, and she turns around to the crowd at one stage and says, where do you want me to serve it? And they said, you know, they're yelling all things. So she goes, okay, so someone said down the tee. So she literally legit hits like a 110 serve down the tee, ace. And then she turns around again to the crowd, and she says, what do you want this one? And they said, you know, whatever. And sure enough, bang, 105, wherever, out wide, ace. And I'm like having a blast with this. And she runs over to the people that suggested this, who've got a PIMS,
sure.
Right? But she runs over to high-five them. I run over also to high-five her and them, but instead of high-fiving them, I actually took their PIMS, took a swig of it, gave it back. I mean, we're trying to have fun, right? Then she says again, where do you want it, right? Sure enough, out wide, bang, out wide. She's three legit aces. And I mean,
unbelievable.
Really good.
Yeah, on demand.
On demand. And then she gets up to the line and some guy yells out, to the body.
Ooh, body serve.
Yeah, but I'm like, you can't ace someone to the body.
No, it's actually doesn't work because it will touch their body, but also it's kind of a dick thing to do.
Well, but the point is that we're like, we're trying to hit an ace. So
yeah.
She stops and looks up. She goes, to the body? And I'm like, what? And then so Conchita then goes, oh, why don't you take it to the body or something? And then Kim and I go, yeah, why don't you get out of the... We have peace. Just keep in mind, we have no idea who yelled out to the body.
Just the person.
We have
voice.
No idea.
Yeah.
So Conchi goes, why don't you? So he stands up and this guy is a big dude.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've seen the video.
So he stands up, comes down on the court, which keep in mind, this is Wimbledon. Like, it's not something that happens. I mean, at any other Grand Slam, you could see this happening because
sure.
Every other Grand Slam is not Wimbledon. Because they're very protective of the grass. They're very protective of safety.
Yeah.
Always.
A plebeian does not get to walk on the
all
hallowed grass.
Things that we didn't take into consideration.
Sure.
But also, it is very easy to get on the courts at Wimbledon. Mm. You can just step over the little fencing. So he comes onto the court. He's got like blue pants on and a green shirt. And so, of course, Kim is now laughing. And then she looks at him and she goes, wait, I love that he's wearing no white. And then all of a sudden her little head ticks over and she goes, wait. So she runs over and grabs an extra skirt out of her bag. Out of her own bag, runs over, gives it to him, and puts it over his legs like she's putting it on her three-year-old. That's what she said. And she's dying laughing. She falls over. Anyway, God love him. He pulls them up.
Yeah.
And they go on.
He's
so
in.
Now I'm like, oh, this is not satisfactory because now you've got a yellow, you've got a green shirt on.
Sure.
So I run and get my, I have a white top that's a long sleeve and it's spandex. So I know it's going to expand. So he goes, he looks at me, he goes, no way. And I go, put it on.
Yeah.
So he puts it on.
Come on, it's the rule.
It is now legit. He's in a white skirt and my white top. And the commentator, which is the best part of this on YouTube, he goes, that's a man at Wimbledon in a skirt receiving serve from Kim Kleisters. I mean, it's just hilarious, right? So God love him, he plays the ball back and we have super fun. We take photos. I mean, it goes viral. It was on the Jimmy Kimmel Show. It was on The View. It was on lots of shows.
And the queen herself did not come down and say,
no,
how dare you invite someone onto a center court.
No, but I will say that the club wasn't super happy the next day.
I believe that.
But I will tell you that they did just post it on their Wimbledon website. So maybe they've forgiven us after all these years. I blamed it all on Kim because I thought they'll keep inviting Kim back forever.
Yeah.
But the great story in the end was that Kim said, keep the skirt.
Sure.
And we found out his name was Chris, I believe, and he kept the skirt. And when he went home, he decided he wanted to sell it as an auction item, and all the money would go to helping provide monetary help for families with children with cancer, so
That's
they could
so
fly.
Great.
He was from Northern, I think he was from Ireland, maybe, and he used to fly them to London. And then Fila, who were Kim's sponsor, said, whatever you get, we'll match.
That's amazing.
And then they flew him when Kim got inducted into the Hall of Fame
that
year.
So
they
cool.
flew him to Newport Beach and they did a bit of an interview, and Kim signed it. I said, can you sign it for him? Yep, no problem. So we all kind of worked together to get it done, and they raised, I think, I can't remember exactly, but I want to say maybe $12,000, $13,000 in total. And he kept the foundation going, and he's been doing, and he got really in shape. He started like losing weight, and yeah, so it was an amazing story in the end. Some people were like, oh, you guys did that.
Next time you could like fit into your skirt or something.
Well, probably. but it ended up being a really
That's
great
so
story.
Cool. I didn't know the end of the story.
Yeah, we raised a lot of money, and yeah, it was fantastic. And he had a blast, and he was such a good sport. So yeah, there's some great things that can happen sometimes.
If anybody hasn't seen it, they absolutely have to search for it on YouTube. It is hilarious. And let's introduce this week's guest. We taped this episode a while ago because we were lucky enough. Speaking of all white, and her name is Anne White. We have the inimitable Anne White, whose story, personal narrative is just amazing. West Virginia to Wimbledon. I mean, that kind of sums it up, right? West Virginia phenom, goes to study with Nick Bollettieri, one of the first, makes a film about it. This film is nominated for Emmys. It is widely considered to be one of the greatest tennis films ever made, called Love Means Zero, about the...
About the Nick.
Nick, who refers to himself constantly in the third person. We talk a lot about that, how that film came to be, her journey, obviously, from West Virginia to Wimbledon and then on to the Beverly Hills Tennis Club, where she's director of tennis. But most notably, and tying back to what we were just discussing about the dress code at Wimbledon, Anne White wore famously
the onesie,
the original bodysuit, all white, head to toe, long sleeve, pony shoes, headband. She looked amazing in it.
Yeah.
It is one of the most indelible images.
It's iconic.
Of tennis, full stop.
The story behind it was so fascinating and so great. And I did not know any of the backstory of how it happened and how it turned out. But, you know, Anne was a great player. And then for this also to happen, and also to hear her thoughts about it, was really interesting to me overall.
I love Anne's approach to tennis so much, because I think turning her life into being an advocate for tennis and pulling juniors in and getting more people engaged, you know, is something that obviously we're really interested in a racket. So it was really cool to hear her story, hear what she's doing now, but also, of course, as you said, hear this like amazingly insane story that I never connected with the image, because there's always a story behind the image. And a lot of people talked about that bodysuit controversy with Serena a couple of years ago. Well, guess what? There was this one before that. Turns out women in bodysuits on professional tennis courts, huge problem, but also an amazing opportunity for comedy and all the rest of it.
I cannot wait for someone to bring it back.
Until then, all right, enjoy this interview with Anne White. You are a storyteller, you're a WTA singles and doubles veteran, you're somebody who now runs a club, but your personal story is not something I think a lot of people know. So let's start there. Where are you? You're West Virginia, you get a racket in your hand. Where does that story start?
That story starts with the Charleston Tennis Club, and my mom was playing in a weekly doubles game, and I was in horseback riding lessons in swimming and ballet, which I did not like, and I was
I don't blame you.
Sort of in trouble because I charged a lot of candy at the club, and my mom made me come to her tennis games, and I had to sit and watch her play. And my two friends were on in a little clinic on the courts below, and they were neener, neener, neener. You can play tennis, ha 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 ha.
Wow!
So that went on a couple
of
weeks.
So it was bullying back then too.
Yeah, yeah.
Good. Good to know.
And I just begged my mom to put me in the class because they kept harassing me, and I hated it. And finally, she just was tired of me bothering her, and she put me in the class. And then 2 days later, the head pro came up and said, your daughter can actually hit the ball over the fence. I'm moving her up with the 9-year-old.
Whoa.
So it was just...
How old were you?
I was 5 and a half.
Oh, shit.
Wait a second. So were you... You are... If for people who don't know you or have only seen pictures of you, you are very tall.
Yeah, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't that tall.
Were you tall then?
No.
She was five. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I wasn't. My dad was a basketball player. He was captain of the WU basketball team.
Oh, wow.
Right before Jerry West came on, he helped recruit Jerry. And so he always had a ball in my hand when I was little, and I'm the oldest child. And so he was always tossing balls with me. And so I just established really good hand-eye coordination from a very young age. And
so you took to it immediately. The hand eye, you could make contact.
Yeah, and then it was like, let's go hit on the wall. And I hit on the wall. The OCD kicked in at a very early age. And then, I could be near the snack bar and get the candy.
Candy was an early thing.
We've just basically told every parent, just if they want their kid to be a tennis player, just carry around Swedish fish.
Yeah.
Just like throw it at them like dogs.
And Mountain Dew,
Yeah, I have to say mine was Fanta. Back then. Remember? Fanta.
Yeah. I used to share a Dr. Pepper with my dad whenever we would finish a set. And it was the thing I looked forward to.
I like the Dr. Pepper too.
Yeah. So you had a natural affinity. It got serious. Was tennis, I mean, obviously there was a club, there was some infrastructure, but was there much of a junior scene when it kind of seemed like you
there was
were
a little bit of
good?
A program? And my mom, mother is, was a school teacher and very organized, and she saw that I was getting good, and there were local tournaments, and the next thing I knew, I was going to Ohio and Michigan and playing in these regionals, and then next thing I knew, I was 9 years old playing in the 12 and under nationals in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Whoa. Next thing you knew.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what's that time span? A year or 2 years?
Like 3 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wait, more importantly, I want to know what happened once you started playing and then those people that were making fun of you. What you did to them. Did you play them and did you beat them? Because I look for the minutiae little comic stories. Like, basically, how did you pay them back?
Yeah.
Well,
do you remember?
They went into swimming and horseback riding. They quickly got out of tennis.
Yeah.
And then, I stuck with tennis. I think I just, I liked the game. I did play high school basketball as well because my dad always had me playing basketball.
It's in the family.
Yeah, so I was just, into sports and loved, hitting the ball. And then, as a kid, you'd look at the map and you'd say, oh my gosh, we get to go to Arkansas or we get to go to Toronto. And my mom would get in her Woody wagon and drive us and we'd go. And it was like an adventure to go do all this stuff.
A Woody wagon.
I know exactly what
that is.
The best. Those are the best.
Wasn't that the Brady Bunch car?
Yeah, they had the big little wood panels on the side.
And three seats. My brother had the far back. I was in the middle, and we had a whole system. And,
it was like a whole family adventure.
Yeah, and then, if I got to the finals, the deal was, my dad says, okay, you get to the finals, I'll fly in. So I love my father. He was, my sports hero. And so I always wanted to do my best and get to the finals so my dad would fly in, and then he'd drive home with us.
Wow.
So...
A very big part of your story, and we're going to get to some of that a little later, but a very big part of your story is your experience in sort of the junior tennis machine. Because at some point, and this is still true today, it's probably more true now than it was, when you start to show promise, you kind of outgrow your local club, you outgrow your local coaches, you get plucked and you get put in a real tennis machine. What happened to get that for you? How did you get to the voluntary, universe? How did it sort of transcend from, okay, this is really good, but it's a family affair, to, oh, wow, I have some real promise, and this is something I need to focus on almost in a 24/7 kind of capacity?
Well, I think, I was really fortunate that in Charleston, West Virginia, the National 16 tournament was played at my club.
Yeah.
It was and still is the nicest tennis club in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And so when I was 9 years old, I was a ball girl for, Chris Evert and Marina Redondo and, all those. So I got to see really good tennis at a young age and really look up to them and, maybe I can get as good. And then, I kept getting in better and better and better. And then when I was 14, I finally got to play at my home club in the National 16s.
Cool.
And Nick was there.
Yeah.
And at this point, he approached my parents and said, I'm going to start this little academy in Florida. And
before he had started?
No, I was the first out-of-state student in Florida.
At Nick Bollettieri.
Yeah. There was me and about eight locals. The DePalmers were there, Mike DePalmer's kids. And And so he,
so said, he recruited you.
He recruited me, and he said to my parents, you know, come down and take a visit. And so we flew down, and we looked, and I saw that beach and that water, and I'm like, okay, I'm in, you know. And so wow. Then I lived with a family. I was fortunate. I didn't have to live at that hotel because I wouldn't have made it. I know I wouldn't have made it. I was spoiled.
Why?
Because it was tough. I mean, it was really tough. I had home-cooked meals every night. I had a really loving family that... Yeah. Took care of me, and you know, in the hotel, it was tough. Yeah. You know, there were kids, you know, 2 to 4 kids in a room, and weekends, you know, you had to do your homework. I mean, there was really not a lot of TLC going around,
yeah.
And I was spoiled in certain ways from my
yeah.
parents.
And for people who don't know this, before Nick Bollettieri built what became the Bollettieri Academy and is now AMG Academy, he was running this out of a kind of rough around the edges tennis club. So this wasn't exactly a facility sort of set up to take in kids,
Local kids. Parents didn't sign releases. I mean, it was like the Wild West. I mean, they sent kids down there.
Yeah.
He got a secondhand bus. He was busting kids around. My parents gave me a light blue Chevy Monte Carlo. Yeah. I was driving kids in the car. I mean, it was crazy, but it was, you know, a wonderful time. We all worked really hard. The pros were great. You had... you know, 2 or 3 kids to one pro, and they worked us hard, and, you know, it was a really fun time.
Yeah. It sounds kind of wild, though.
Oh, wild. I mean, nobody, you know.
Who were some of the people that were there, like, in pivotal times, like 1 or 2 years that you were like, God, thank God they were here, or, God, I hate them, or, you know, like, which ones, you know, players do you remember? Because we all grew up in sort of academy-like atmosphere, well, not everybody, but some of us have, and so there's certain people that were always pushing you, or... pushing your buttons, or thank God they were there. Like, do you remember one or two?
Well, I mean, I started second semester of my sophomore year, and then a couple months later, Jimmy Arias came down.
Mm-hmm.
So then Jimmy moved into Nick's house.
Yeah.
And then shortly after that, Paul Anacone came down.
So
Paul was there. Pablo Araya was there,
sure.
who was a lot of fun and didn't speak a lot of English at the time, and he was a character. And then Kathleen Horvath came down.
Yeah.
Then Pam Casale came down. And then when I left, then I went to USC to college. And then I remember, you know, going back to Florida from time to time, and people would be, oh, it's getting big now. So-and-so's come. Then Krickstein came down.
Yeah.
So, you know, slowly more and more kids were coming. And, you know, back then you had Port Washington in New York, which was kind of an academy. You had Hopman's. And then you had people that were with Lansdorp out west, but you really didn't have...
Yeah.
I mean, you had, you know, Chris Everett's dad in Miami, and you had a group of kids that came out of there, but there, you know, there weren't really like it is today, where everybody has an academy and all that. And Nick was smart. He took all these kids that were from cold climates and said, hey,
come on down to Florida. You
can practice 3 to 4 hours a day instead of 3 to 4 hours a week. And sure enough, like anything, you put that kind of time in, there's going to be improvement. You're going to get better. And he put us all against each other and created all this tension and competition. And,
so
you know,
you
everybody got really good.
Who was the person you hated the most? Probably
I didn't hate anybody. I didn't.
Who was the person that you played against? You were like, God, if I can beat her, I know I'm going to be good.
You know, there are a few people that I played in juniors that I never beat, like Tracy Austin and Pam, you know, in juniors. I'd lost in 3 sets to both of them, and I never quite beat them in singles. But, you know, I was always setting my own standards for really wanting to be as good as I could be, and I didn't really dislike people. It was just I wanted to...
Well, you're a good diplomat. For the job you're currently doing, which is 12 years, and Renee's trying to get in fights over there, and why you're not. But I want to talk a little bit about college tennis, because obviously it was a different time. You played at USC. Getting a springboard from the NCAA level into the pro level, it's kind of happening here and there now again, but there was a time when I was growing up watching your Capriati's, your Hingis's, college wasn't even remotely on the map. But for you, that was a stepping stone. And was it an obvious one? Or did you kind of think, well, let me cool my heels here for a little bit and maybe I'll try to go pro immediately? What was your thinking
about
that?
Oddly enough, my parents and Nick had, they sat up all night and they had a huge argument.
Really?
All night. And Nick was insistent that I turn pro. He didn't want me to go to college. And my parents put their foot down and said, you know, we want her to go to school.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad I did, because... It is brutal out there.
Yeah.
And I made some of the best friends of my life to this day at USC. I joined a sorority. I had fun. And, you know, freshman year, we were undefeated and national champs. And and I got to grow up a little bit. I mean, I'd led a sheltered life and traveled and all that. But, I mean, you know how it is, Renee. I mean, you're not making a ton of decisions for yourself and learning about the real world out there. And, you know, I went out to Los Angeles. I mean, now I say to my parents, I'm like, oh, my God, you sent me to Knicks. You sent me to SC, which is in the worst
part
of LA.
What were you trying to tell me?
I'm like, yeah. I'm like, what were you all thinking? They're like, well, you wanted to go. And I was like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, totally. They're probably like, you're fine. You turned out just fine.
Yeah,
totally. But did you feel like you gained friendship experience? Did your tennis game improve? Because I would imagine that was probably Nick's counterpoint, right? You're going to maybe stall out and not get the next level exposure.
I was playing some pro tournaments, and, you know, my ranking was, I don't even remember, I was still an amateur, and I was having fun. I mean, I never really thought, oh, I want to be a pro tennis player. I always just sort of, oh, my gosh, maybe I can get a college scholarship. Wow, I can get to California. I mean, I was like, my whole thing was, I don't want to be cold. I want to go where it's warm. You know, it's Florida or California. And then when I started playing some pro tournaments like my freshman and sophomore year in college, all of a sudden I'm 35 in the world on the pro circuit and I'm still in college. And then IMG was calling and all that. And then it was like, wow, maybe I am going to go to Wimbledon. You know, this is going to happen. But, you know, for me, it seemed so far away and so, like, you know.
Outside the realm of conception.
Yeah, like, you know,
I think some people don't realize it. There are some players that certainly, you know, at the age of five, they're getting told they're going to win Wimbledon, and some of them actually do believe that, and actually that happens. You know, you talk about Serena and saying she wanted to be number one in the world, and this is when she was like 10. And I mean, there are people that really set their sights on that is it. But I would say the majority of players, their aspirations are to play at Wimbledon or at a French Open or at a Grand Slam. And then there's thinking, how well can I do? And then if it actually does happen where you win a slam in singles or doubles, you're just like, holy shit, I can't believe this actually happened to me.
Right.
And not like, I can't believe it, like I'm not good enough. Like, wow, I cannot believe if I look back to 20 years ago when I was 10. And you said you're definitely going to win. I know for a fact. You'd be like, really?
Yeah.
Like it's so, you can't conceptualize that as a kid. You know,
no,
so but some do and some manifest it and they are incredible.
And
you know,
I just think I was more realistic that, you know, I knew that.
Well, you're you're normal. That's a normal reaction.
I don't know how normal, but
that's a normal reaction.
Yeah, and also I also didn't train as I could have trained hard. I was gifted, you know, I was a good athlete because of the hand-eye thing and I didn't want to sacrifice everything in my life. I just saw what it took and what those people, and I just thought, that's not me. You know, I want to do other things too.
You want to have interests.
Yeah, and I just, you know.
So flash forward, you're on the tour. You got those calls from IMG. You got the calls from the agents. You are 35 in the world, but still playing NCAA tennis. Was there a moment where you sort of said, okay, now I got to dive in. Now I got to plunge in.
Yeah.
I owe it to myself to just see what this is. Was that how it felt?
Yeah, well, it was just like, this is you're up, and this is the time, because I'd seen other players that had stayed in school and not taken that chance, and then their ranking dropped, and then they finished school, and then you realize it's like, look, I gotta catch that train. If I don't catch that train, I'm not gonna get to where I need to go. And so you know, that was the decision I made, and didn't start out well at all. I mean, you know, once I got out there, it was like, whoa, you know, this is for real now. This is cool.
This episode of the Racket Magazine podcast is brought to you by Sergio Tacchini, revitalizing and disrupting the status quo since 1966. Follow them on Instagram at @SergioTacchini_official and go to SergioTacchini.com for more. Enter the promo code RACKETMAG at checkout and you'll get 30% off your order.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So,
how long did it take you to get your footing under you?
A couple of years. To really understand, you know, how you pick your tournaments, you know, how you travel and what surfaces. I mean, you know, there's a lot, you know, it's a whole science to figure out how to peak when you need to.
It's not just hitting balls.
Yeah.
Yeah. And did you feel like, I mean, obviously we have to talk about the bodysuit. It's a bold, ballsy thing. How much can you tell us about it? There is an iconic image that will accompany this podcast episode. Let's talk about Anne White, bodysuit, Wimbledon. As much as you want to say, get us the full picture.
All right. Well, I was dating Ian Hamilton, who was the global marketing head of Nike, and he gave me these paneled tights. I have on tights right now because I love them. I'm 5'11 and tall, and they keep my legs warm. And he gave me these tights. It was 1985, and they kept my legs warm. And so it was a joke one day to him. I said, can you imagine a white bodysuit at Wimbledon? Wouldn't that be funny? And
it was your idea.
Yeah, he said, oh, yeah, that would be great. Everybody go nuts there. They would hate that. That would just be, you know. So I didn't really think anything of it. And then we went to the French Open, and we met a guy named Carlo Grippa, who was the head of Nike Italy. And he's a real character. He'd been in the Olympics for track and field himself, so he was an athlete. And I really explained, because Ian had given me the tights during the winter circuit. When it was cold, we were playing in, like, Chicago and Boston and places like that. Yeah. You're tall. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I really liked how they made my legs feel warmer and possibly prevent injury and all that.
Sure, and circulation.
So anyhow, Carlos said, I'll get it made. And, I take that back. I jump forward a little bit. I was under contract with Pony. So before we met Carlo, he went to Nike to tell them, you know, my great idea. So I thought, and you want to buy her contract out? Yeah. And they just kind of laughed and said, no, thanks. And then, so then we went to the French Open, met Carlo, and then he was, you know, contraband. I'll get it made. Da, 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 da. And so he got it made, and then sent it over. He says, I'll send it to your flat in London, blah, 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 blah. Well, it rained the first 3 days. I was playing Shriver the first round, and we were scheduled the first day, and then it didn't show up till Thursday morning. I didn't play till Thursday.
Wow.
Oh, my God. It was destiny.
Destiny. Yeah. So it shows up in your room, and you're like, well, I guess I got to go
Yeah,
out.
It came. It came. And then,
the first thought, though, when it did come and you hadn't played a first round, were you like, Were you like, fuck, I've really got to do this now?
And now I'm in, yeah.
Well, when I put one suit on, I was definitely not going to do it because it was so sheer. I was like, I can't do it. He sent two. He had made two. Oh. And one was sleeveless, and then the other one was long sleeve, and there was no way I could wear just one. So I had two suits on.
You wore two simultaneous bodysuits?
Yeah.
No, so it was actually two suits.
Yeah. It was a double suit.
How great would it have been if you'd gotten hot and you just stripped off one and they think you're going naked and they're like, well, calm down, All England Club. We've got another one underneath. Yeah.
Controversial. They would have put you on the wall or banned you from the tournament forever. Either way.
So then a dear friend of mine was staying with me.
Wait. Were they hot? Were the two on?
No, because it was cooler there. Yeah, we didn't start till 7 o'clock at night.
It's always often cold at Wimbledon.
Then you know, because it stays late, we didn't start till like 7.
Yeah,
and so it was freezing. And it doesn't take much for, you know, I don't like being cold at all. You know, 52 is cold.
So you didn't feel impeded. You felt
No.
You weren't self-conscious. I mean, it's a
yes.
Well, hold on. So you put the two suits on in your room, and you're like, all right.
No, I changed in the shower.
At Wimbledon.
Yeah, in the middle locker room, and I have Robin White and Mary Lou Daniels, two of my frequent doubles partners. Yeah. They were on the lookout. Yeah, they were on the lookout. So I was in the shower and. They were laughing. They were like, "Oh, you've done it now, man! Way to go!" Yeah. You know.
Wait. So you get changed in the shower?
Yeah. Then I put a tracksuit.
On over the top, pants as well.
Oh yeah.
And so you got pants and a top on, so nobody knows what's
and
underneath. Nobody,
and Ian walked me to the court. So once I got out of the locker room, he saw that I got to the court, and nobody really knew.
And so then here we are. You're like slowly unzipping.
Then we warmed up.
You warmed up in your suit. Okay.
I warmed up in the tracksuit. Then at that point, I thought. My heart might explode. I'm like, I've really done it. I'm going to have a heart attack and die right on the floor. My heart was like beating out my
chest. And you're playing Pam?
Yeah.
Oh, this is even better.
Yeah. And Pam and I go way back to juniors. And,
Okay.
So
she
was not thrilled that. So anyhow, so then the umpire said, prepare to play. And so I went over and I took off the suit. And then literally this guy, he turned purple. And I thought we were going to have to paddles out to revive him and me with the heart attack.
Wait, were there like audible gasps?
Well, people were like, ooh, you know, ooh, ooh.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody audible gasps in Wimbledon. And they just go, ooh, ooh.
Yeah.
Oh.
And then she served the first game and I shanked.
Wait. Before she started, though, because this is my. So you take the suit off and you walk back, and does she say anything? Does Pam go,
she
what
just,
the F?
Just like gave me a look like,
whatever.
Yeah. And,
two big chicks out there too.
Yeah, those are
six feet,
totally slugfest. Okay, so
she looks at you. She walks back to serve, and you're like, "Oh, fuck, yeah, here we go."
And Mary Lou and Robin are laughing. I can see them over in the stands laughing so hard, you know. And I'm just, oh my god. So anyhow, then she serves the first game, and I shank balls. I mean, I can barely hit the ball.
Yeah,
I was so nervous. And then
do you remember?
It was court two. And then the rule is once you play one point, they can't make you change clothes.
Oh.
Which I found out.
Wow, I can't believe they didn't get out there sooner.
Yeah. So then I lost the first set bad. I didn't play well the first set. And then the second set, I came back, was down two match points, and I came back in a tiebreaker 7-6. And
oh,
I was on
so
fire.
Happy.
I was playing so well.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I look up and we're losing the light.
Oh,
I mean,
no.
It's down. And I'm like, dang. And Alan Mills walks up and he talks to the umpire and he said, match is being called due to darkness. We'll resume tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. And then he says to me and he says, we need to take a little walk to the office.
It's like you're going to the principal's office.
Oh, here
office.
We go. I'm going to be kicked out of Wimbledon. I'm going to be fined. I'm in serious trouble.
Yeah, I love Alan too. He's the best.
Yeah, and he was very nice and we walked and then he said, we have to ask you not to wear that again. That is not suitable attire in the All England Club. And I told him, you know, fashion and function and, you know, all, you know, my my whole spiel for selling the bodysuit. And at the end, he said, you understand? And I said, yes, I do. It was even cooler the next morning we played. And I lost 6-3 in the third and just in a skirt and a top. So,
blame it on Alan.
Alan, you could have. You were on the roll there, and also the late roll.
Yeah. Alan, the light killed
you. You played two glorious sets. Well, one glorious set and two technical sets in an outfit that hadn't been seen until 3 years ago at the French Open, which also caused controversy. So it's just meant to be. We'll have to bring it back somehow.
Okay.
Some way. Limited edition.
It's time.
Capsule collection.
Yeah, I think the racket.
Racket.
I think we'll come
Anne
up with something
White
pretty
collab.
Amazing.
You know, no pressure, but I think we're going to have a business chat after this.
We need to have
another racket.
We need to have people tweet us, write us, and let us know.
Yeah, would you buy the bodysuit? Let us know. We'll put some into production. So I want to fast forward a little bit because you had an incredible career. You played.
Wait a second. Wait. But before this,
after
this, I mean, it was controversial and it was a huge story. I mean, everybody heard about it.
Yeah.
It was like a big deal. If you bring this up, like to anyone, they go, "Oh, the white bodysuit, right?" Mm-hmm. I mean, anyone who knows anything about tennis, What was it like after the match? And because, you know, obviously it's not social media. Can you imagine now, Case? Oh. Holy shit. Like, you'd be a meme, you know, yeah, or a GIF.
Yeah.
A GIF.
Maybe are a GIF.
Maybe
right?
are.
Check
you,
right
could,
now.
You probably are. But, like, did you feel like it changed anything about you? Like,
yeah, it did. It actually did, because I had gotten a little complacent, and it made me train harder. And I was like, you know what?
To get into the
you know,
mindset.
I thought, wow, you know, my obituary's already been written now. I better do something else. And I wanted to, you know, have a little stronger career and play a little better. And I thought,
because you were more noticed.
Well,
a
yeah,
bit from
and
it.
I didn't want to be just be the girl that wore the white suit.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a pretty good junior career and good collegiate career and. Then I, you know, I was in the 60s and I wanted to, you know, I thought realistically I can get in the top 20. I mean, I thought I can get in the top 20.
Yeah.
And I did. I got to 19 and I wanted to win a tournament in singles. And I said, you know, everyone said, oh, you're a doubles player. You'll never win a tournament in singles. And I'm like, you watch. And so I started training with John Lloyd a little bit.
Yeah.
And working out with his trainer and running the perimeter of UCLA and really pushing myself hard, which I hadn't done. And 6 weeks later, I won a tournament in singles. So
six
that was
weeks.
A, yeah, that yeah. was a year that last year that I played. You know, I won.
Do
eight.
You regret that? Like looking back on it, like there's certain things about my career, certainly in singles, that I do regret. One of them was not working harder when I was younger.
Yeah,
I worked very hard, but it took. And I'm talking like 24, 25 is when I really started to push myself a lot in
mm-hmm.
singles. But prior to that, I relied on my talent, and I was kind of having too much fun and. I wanted people to like me, and I was just whatever, you know, as opposed to. But I was always a good doubles player, but singles. I do regret that about my career, you know. Do you regret it a little bit, looking back on it?
You know, I my game was limited. You know, I had a weak backhand, you know. I mean, I started out with a two-hander growing up, then I went to a one-hander, I went back to the two-hander.
No, like Caitlin.
And
just like me, and all my Wimbledon.
You know, I have a good drop shot, and
yeah.
So I had a weakness in my game, and you know, I really wanted to win a tournament, and then I also saw what happens when you're past your prime, and then people are playing qualifying, and I never played qualifying at Wimbledon, or and I didn't want to be that person. Mm. You know, that was not the way I wanted to go out, and so I felt. Pretty darn good that, you know, I got to top 20 and the only regret that I really, really have is Wimbledon, I think it was 84 and I had gotten to the finals of the Birmingham tournament and lost to Pam. And then first round, I had two match points against a qualifier, the Swedish girl in Carlson or something like that, and I lost. And she went on to the quarters. And that was my opportunity where I really, on grass, I was a strong player. And I could have, you know, gotten to the quarters. Because I didn't get in the Final Eight there. I'm in the Final Eight Club in French in the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
But only got to the quarters at Wimbledon. So that I'm kind of bummed about. But other than that, I mean, I'm just grateful. I look back on it now and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I did all that. You know, so.
Especially because you made such a concerted effort to do, okay, the goals, especially top 20, win a singles tournament. I mean, that's what's always remarkable to me. It's just, you know, how much could we do when we just decide? I read about these women who marathon, who are sort of amateur marathoners. Like, I'm going to qualify. One of them just qualified for the Olympics just because you don't think it's in your conception or your ability to do that. And then all of a sudden when it becomes something that is a goal, you're amazed how much your body responds. Shifting a little bit, when we first met, and you were gracious enough to have me at the club, and I want to get to that in a minute, and your game is, you hit me up the court, obviously. You walked away from the game for a time. You had a moment where you didn't have, you sort of needed to put the rackets down, business. What was it that sort of your time away kind of gave to you, and what brought you back?
I was just tired of traveling. I just didn't want to do it anymore. I mean, I felt like I didn't know the difference between a Wednesday and a Saturday, and I got as good as I was going to get.
Yeah.
I mean, I realized that I wasn't going to get any better, and I didn't want to be that person, as I said earlier. So, and then I had other interests. So, you know, I worked for Ralph Lauren in New York and LA, and then got in the watch business, and I love timepieces and antique cameras and that sort of thing. So I worked for Cartier and Jaeger LeCoultre in the wholesale watch business.
How did you get into all of that? No,
I was called by a headhunter for something else, and then they said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I like watches. And they said, oh, well, the Cartier person is coming, and so one thing led to another. And
is that from your connections with tennis, or is that business?
No, it wasn't through tennis. It was just through a headhunter. They wanted me for some suntan, working for suntan lotion or whatever.
But
so.
Did they know you because you were a former tennis player? No, not at all.
This is someone they just called out of the blue. Because
that's amazing.
So I'd gone to work, like I said, for Ralph Lauren in New York and L.A., and then ended up working for Cartier and Jaeger LeCoultre. And then I traveled 150. Then I was born.
You were traveling more.
150,000 miles a year.
Wow.
Working for Jaeger LeCoultre for 10 years. And yeah. I hit the wall. And I was like, because of tennis and this, I felt like a gypsy. I'm like, you know what? This is enough. And I just didn't want to be at the airport anymore. And,
sure,
So I took time off and did some other things. And then my parents have a home in Florida on Longboat Key because they bought a home years ago because I was down there for my tennis.
Yeah.
And it was right across from the Colony. And that's the beach I walk. And I had lunch with Nick because he came to my dad's 75th birthday. And we stayed in touch, obviously, all these years. And then I went and saw the IMG Academy and we had lunch. And I said, you know, holy shit, Nick. I said, somebody needs to do a movie on you. I said, let me go back to LA and see what I could do. Yeah. So one of my dear friends is Jill Mazursky, who's done a bunch of films, and I spoke to her about Nick, and she said, great, let's see what we can do. And then one thing led to another, and we found a great director, and we're able to pull this together, and we're shut down twice, mm-hmm. Which film almost didn't happen.
Yeah.
And then spent 3.5 years really, and I was very passionate about it because of my time that I spent with Nick, and I see what's happened today. And also because I feel strongly that American tennis, except for the Williams sisters, was in its heyday with when Nick...
It's true.
When Nick had all the players there, and it was kooky as all get out.
Yeah.
But he created that drive and that passion and that intensity. And
there's almost too many academies now.
Oh, for sure. And there's something about Nick that is so unique that it will never happen again. I mean, it was like that perfect storm,
and
perfect recipe of everything coming together at the right time. And I wanted to get that story out and really tell how this all came together and what all he did. And so I put the movie together, and then we happened to have all our meetings at the Beverly Hills Tennis Club. And then the president of the club is my ear, nose, and throat doctor. And he said, Russell's leaving. Russell Simpson had been the pro for 17 years. And said, Russell's leaving. What do you think? And I said, well, shoot, I've been hanging around Nick for 3.5 years. I mean, let me see. So I never, ever thought I would be doing what I'm doing now. And I've never had so much fun. I mean, I work with so many great kids. And it's just a blast. And the club is just a... You know, it was started by Groucho Marx and Charlie Chaplin 90 years ago because they didn't let them in LA Tennis Club, so they started their own club.
Yeah, it's a great club.
It's a cute little throwback club and wonderful people. And, you know, hopefully I'm helping some people with their tennis games. And I take these kids. I've had two matches this past weekend with the kids' team. They're like, you know, between 9 and 11. And they'll come off the court, hey, I got a bagel. And, you know, I mean, it's a lot of fun. And keeps me fairly fit and
I should say. Well, let me ask you one more question about Love Means Zero, which is amazing. If anybody hasn't seen it, who's listening to this, nominated for an Emmy, you had accolade after accolade, you got shut down, you almost didn't happen. This basically, as far as I can understand it, came together because literally your force of will. What for people like us who know some of the story about Nick, I trained at Ball Terry for a little bit when I was a junior. For those of us in the world, it captured something really amazing about that time. But what I love about it is it talks to everybody. And what do you think the response and the accolades it's gotten from people who haven't spent a lot of time in our world means? You know, what does that feel like, and how did that kind of take form?
Well, I know Nick, you know, Nick's a character, and he said people stop him all the time now and say, Nick, we loved your movie, You know, I think he was... very honest and authentic, and it was difficult, some of the stuff that he went through, but he got to really speak his mind, and he was confronted with some bad choices that he made, you know, and
did he seem to understand that?
Yeah, I think he did. And
Nick understood.
I think he did. I mean, at the end, you know, when he tears up a little bit about what happened with Andre, and you know, it's. But you know, as you know, the coach player relationship is walking the tight wire, and at any moment, you can get yanked either way, and it's a tough dance. And I think Nick never charged me a penny.
Wow.
For 2.5 years, my parents paid to live with the family, but Nick never charged me.
Yeah.
I was one of many, many, many students, great students that he had. During the course of the film, going to dinner parties or talking to various people all across the country, there wasn't anyone that I didn't encounter that hadn't had their child go to voluntary.
Do you think that was a mistake, though, like looking back on it for him as a business, obviously, as a business proposition, he made his mistakes based on idealism.
Yeah, you know? It's interesting. Not on
practicality.
Oh, for sure.
Nick was a great motivator, coach, terrible businessman. You know what I mean? Like, if he could go back 50 years, you know, 40 years and say, all right, this is how we're going to do this again.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
You're going to run the tennis, but you need someone to run your business.
But you know, he was a pioneer. You know,
yeah.
he was one of the first to do that.
Yeah, there wasn't even a business model.
Yeah, and so I think also, you know, Nick has no rearview mirror. I mean, I think he does a little bit now, but he really didn't then. It was just on to the next player, and that's who he was. On to the next, and on to the next, and yet there's this huge heart that wants to help every kid. And mm-hmm. let me help you, and he just didn't think it through. You know, clearly,
that's what I mean.
But yet. At the end of the day, as a coach and a teacher, there's a unique bond that all of us have that went to Nick's you know, knew that it was a kooky thing, but yet it was like very magical. I mean, you know,
are you and Jimmy Arias? Like, do you?
Yeah,
like,
I see Jimmy.
You guys talk you have a probably very intense bond because of this, right?
Oh yeah, like, all of us that were there. There anybody that went to Nick's? I mean, we just kind of go, oh my gosh, you know, we.
There was a lot. I mean, even like Ann Grossman, who's here coaching, you know. You know, she went there during Andre's time, and those guys, and they were like 14 and 13 years of age.
And here comes Becker, and then
Boris was in there.
All of the players that came through. I mean, that's the one thing about now is that I think there are too many academies because you dilute.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas Nick, everyone went there.
Yeah.
So everyone's pushing themselves. So one of the things that Nick had to decide was who's he going to choose, you know? And that became his downfall in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, there are so many...
Because he had to play favorites, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I love Nick to death. I mean, you know, anytime he walks by me, he says, hey, coach! You know, he just has a passion that is unmistakable.
Yeah.
But I think that looking back on it, boy, if he just had someone organizing this better, it could have been so much better.
I mean, Nick was
for
like the circus that came to town.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it was just this, totally. Oh, Nick's doing this. Oh my God, boy, he just did that. And, I mean, it was just, and like I said, Paris didn't sound releases. I mean, it was a crazy time. And that's why I felt that it needed to be explained and documented, because it gave birth now to, you know, the IMG Academy, which is a whole different thing.
A level of professionalization and, you know.
I would have lasted about 2 hours there. I'm not so sure that would have been the right environment for me.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you look at, and this is just my little opinion here, but Lansdorf or Segura or Hopman, and these kooky guys, the kids, there's something magical that happens that gets these kids motivated, and you get these cookie cutter places,
it's
and
not
it's not
factory.
The same experience.
I'll tell you what it is. It's passion.
Yeah.
Period. That's it. It's a passion for teaching. Nick was a terrible businessman, but he loved to help kids, and he loved to make them better tennis players.
Yeah.
And he had that Italian passion that was just like never ending. And that's, you know, Lansdorf. You talk about all those great coaches.
Well,
you know,
I mean, Lansdorf had great technique. I mean, I think, you know, Nick
taught the passion of that technique.
Yeah, yeah, true.
It's like nonstop. That's how you're going to hit it. That's how you're going to hit it. That was his vision, you know, nonstop. I mean, you know, I think that's the most important thing with coaching. And you know, people always ask me, well, what do I tell my kid? I'm like, find a passionate coach. It's the most important thing you can teach your young children.
Yeah.
Because they have to be instilled with that passion. And I think Nick gave that to people. I mean, you can attest to this more than I can.
Yeah,
but
it's
like waking up and going, if I can't have the same passion as Nick, then I might as well just leave. Yeah. Right? I mean,
well, I mean, you know, I mean, I have to say I'm very passionate. You know, I work with a kids team.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're at the beginning of the season. I say, okay, you know, what's our goal? You want to play on your high school team or your junior high team? You know, we start with the small goals, but, you know, they show up to practice all the time. They have their uniform. They're out there playing. And, you know, I mean,
but you're making my point for me.
Yeah. No, I am trying to make your point that it's just like, you know, you can't, you know, do things. You know, there's no B team. There's no junior varsity. You know, you go, you're all in 100%.
Yeah.
And I think for any of us that have played at that level, you know, that's what it takes, you know. And you don't, just because you stop doing that, you have to find a place for that in your life, whether it's, you know, teaching or playing with Super 8 cameras or, you know, whatever.
You've got to find
and that's sort of one of the keys to having a fulfilling life, I think.
I mean, that's a good
place to end it.
You've
got the magazine. Yeah, you've got a child. And, you know.
I know. No, I mean, for me, it's about convening community around this sport that I love to make them love it as much as I do, so we can widen the tent and make the sport healthy, because I want people to feel and understand how cool it is. Last question for you. We're going to test out the idea. Listeners, let us know. Ann White bodysuit redux 2020-21. Another film, a TV show. What do you think? What's next for you in terms of that world?
I've got a couple ideas I'm working on, but nothing.
Okay.
You know, the film was 3.5 years and a huge chunk of my childhood, and you know, a completely passionate project, and so thrilled with what happened. But you know, I'm all in the club now. I'm loving club life. It's full circle. I'm back to we don't quite have the candy snack bar that we used to have at the Charleston Tennis Club, but
but we've eaten there. The food is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, well, thank you.
Yeah,
they have great ice lattes.
Yes, we've eaten there.
Yes,
but I'm having fun at the club, and you know, I've got a couple little projects that I'm working on and doing my Super 8 little videos for fun. And
Ann White, thank you so much for being
so
on our show.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Thanks
for coming by.
I love those stories.
And that's it for this episode of the Racket Magazine podcast. Thanks for listening. Our host is Renee Stubbs. Our co-host and producer is me, Caitlin Thompson. Music by internationally renowned DJ Stretch Armstrong. Thanks to Tim Rogerian and the team at Acast. Find us at racketmag.com/podcast and subscribe to us at any of your favorite podcatchers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.